This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Michael Daventry, and coming up on this program, we need to talk about Poland, specifically its view of the Holocaust. New laws and court cases are challenging what most of us consider to be historical fact, and the implications have been international. We talk to a history professor who's just won a court case defending his own book, and to a panel to discuss whether Poland can ever come to terms with its past. Poland in the 1930s was home to one of the world's largest Jewish populations. In the Second World War, it became the country where more Jews were killed than any other. It happened because Poland was under Nazi occupation, and the extermination camps were built there. There are many stories of Polish heroism, of ordinary people putting their lives and livelihoods at risk to help save Jewish lives at the time. But this was war, and there are dark stories too. For the stories of gallantry and altruism, there are cases of collaboration, when ordinary Poles contributed to the Holocaust. One such case concerned a man called Edward Malinowski. He was a village elder, and his story appeared in a single paragraph of a book published 3 years ago. It said he told the authorities where Jews were hiding in the forest. The village elder's niece is today 80 years old. She took the authors to court, saying they had defamed her uncle, and earlier this year a court agreed with her. It ordered the book's authors to apologise and to remove the paragraph from future editions of the book. But on Monday, an appeals judge overturned that decision. She said an apology was not necessary, and that asking for one could have a chilling effect on academic research in Poland. The book's editor was Professor Jan Grabowski. Before talking to him about the lawsuit, I asked him who the village elder was and how he had collaborated with the Nazis.
First of all, let me just tell you that the book is a huge undertaking under my and my colleagues' editorial, let's say, care. 2 volumes, 9 historians, 6 years of hard work, you know, dozens of archives, thousands of documents. And the little paragraph that actually found itself at the middle of this, in the center of this legal tornado, and it was written actually in a chapter by my colleague, Professor Engelking, and it dealt with a village elder from remote village in northeastern Poland. And it was not a central account to the story, of course. It was one of the many, many thousands of names which were mentioned in the book. In this paragraph, my colleague presented various 3 sources regarding this village elder. And one said that he was doing fine, he was an honest man. And 2 other sources actually denounced him as someone who betrayed the Jews and someone who was complicit in their death. My colleague, as historians do, gave credibility to 1 source or 2 sources that she found based on her experience more convincing than the other, and she sort of, you know, quoted them. And then the lawsuit began, allegedly instigated or started by the niece of this long deceased village elder. In reality, however, the whole thing has been steered, financed, and let's say prepared by something called the Redoubt of Defense of the Good Name of the Polish Nation, which is a proxy for the Polish government, basically.
So specifically in this one paragraph, was there any detail about the way in which Jewish people were betrayed by him or said to have been betrayed, or was it simply just he collaborated and so did other people?
No, there was more. There was actually more detail. The thing is that in this little paragraph, and the question was that this elder, village elder in question, simply denounced the area of residence of Jews in hiding in local forest, and together with the local forest ranger informed the German authorities, who then descended on the Jews and simply slaughtered them. Now, the thing with the sources is that the source which exonerated the village elder was a Polish trial in Polish court from 1950. And these trials had very peculiar dynamic. A Jewish witness in 1950, after Kielce pogrom, 4 years, Jews who stayed in Poland actually decided to throw in their lot with the Poles, okay? The last thing they would do in a Polish court in 1950 would be to denounce other Poles of being complicit in murdering the Jews. So this Jewish witness who was at the center of this account, actually in 1950, she exonerated this village elder. And then fast forward many years later, when she was in Sweden in safety, she basically said, what was the real story? So now a historian who studies these things knows very well that if you have Jewish witness testifying in Polish court in 1948, 49, 50, and accusing Poles, it's a very rare bird. However, if you have a Jewish witness at that stage actually giving the proof of good conduct to Poles, usually it's done under tremendous pressure. These people actually can get killed if they don't. So this is the kind, you know, of things which courts have absolutely no idea about, and things which we as Holocaust historians tend to know by heart, right?
So let's come to today. I mean, you've talked about it a little bit already, but the chapter wasn't written by you, but you edited the whole book. So that's why you were named in the lawsuit alongside Professor Engelking. Can you tell us what went through your mind? When you first got the initial lawsuit, purportedly from the niece of the person named in the chapter, what was going through your mind? What did you feel?
Okay, well, it was not a surprise, you know, because 4 years ago, 2 years actually before this lawsuit has been filed, and the same organization, this redoubt of good name of Polish nation, made the very, I would say, energetic attempt to get me fired from my position of professor of history in Ottawa, sending to rector's office absolutely awful letters full of hateful speech. In any case, so I knew that they were geared for me. So this lawsuit was directed actually at my colleague Engelking. I had no place, to be honest with you, actually, in that whole process, because I was an co-editor of a scientific volume, and you cannot expect an editor of such a publication to go after every footnote and to go compare original documents in the archives. Nobody does it, nowhere in the world. But visibly, they wanted simply to have my hide on their mantelpiece as a hunting trophy, because I became, in the meantime, as they call it, the main enemy of the Polish people. So I wasn't surprised. The problem is I did not anticipate the level or the degree to which the Polish authorities would basically align themselves with extreme Polish right. They are the one, and they pop into this nationalistic, vengeful scenery, millions of whatever you use as a payment, I think is pounds, right? So tens of millions of pounds, actually more than that, just to propel this kind of investigations, and their obsession with history infuses the scenery, so to say. So I wasn't surprised.
And yet, when the court case came, we were talking about the initial court case at this stage, right, there was a demand not just for an apology, but for compensation. So it could have been a very, very expensive undertaking, this, for you, and presumably it already has through legal fees.
Yeah, no, the thing is that we have excellent lawyers who were so kind to work pro bono, two of them, for us. So this is still not a major problem. However, the damages, they wanted damages to the tune of equivalent of 20,000 British pounds, which is probably 2.5 year average salary in Poland. More importantly, they wanted us to not only apologize, to admit that we deliberately falsified the history in order to satisfy our anti-Polish, obsessions. I'm exaggerating now, but this was the gist of it. So that was one thing. And the second thing, they wanted to have the court recognize, and that was their real goal here, that any time a historian or other scholar does something that hurts the national pride of the Polish nation, it's not legally defined concept, every Pole has a right to file a civil lawsuit. And that actually was at the heart of our here struggle, because this was, which went way beyond, individual civil court case.
And they also wanted you to amend the textbook, didn't you, to remove the paragraph out of subsequent editions?
apologies, compensation, broader legislation, and rewriting of the offending paragraph, and also publishing our apologies in various kinds of media, which would cost probably more than the potential compensation itself. So it was a packed lawsuit, which was to put fear into the entire academic community in Poland, and to basically, it's called so-called slap lawsuit, which has so-called chilling, which is supposed to introduce chilling effect. And by the way, this is exactly what Prime Minister of Poland, Mr. Morawiecki, announced 3 years back when they decriminalized infamous Polish Holocaust law. He said, well, okay, we will draw the criminal provisions. We are not going to put historians in jail, but let them be warned, the Polish state has the civil procedure using the NGOs at hand in order to make them respect our nation. So this is exactly what happens.
And that phrase, chilling effect, was used, correct me if I'm wrong, was used by the judge this week in the appeal case, in the hearing when...
I mean, this was right.
Yes, let's talk about that in just a second. I firstly want to talk about you. You must have been massively relieved when the appeal hearing came in the way that it did.
I must tell you, I wasn't nervous until very recently, because, you know, one thing is when you see, you know, a car coming from afar, something different when it stares you straight in the face. So actually, on the day of this announcement of the sentence, I was very tense, of course, because, you know, the scenarios were not very good. I decided to refuse any apologies whatsoever. And, you know, if you refuse apologies in time, you are being fined. If you refuse to pay fines, it's being transformed into prison terms. The thing is that the Polish state, which I consider in terms of Holocaust history a rogue state at this point, they have committed resources and they are not going to, knowing them, they are not very intelligent people, but they are very persistent. And this nationalistic credo is something they are made of. So probably, they will come back to, you know, to look for vengeance, probably.
But that's a fascinating phrase that you used there, a rogue state in terms of Holocaust research, because the last thing I wanted to ask you was, is Poland a good place at the moment to study the Holocaust?
Oh, yes, it's absolutely. This is the epicenter. I mean, if you want to study not only the Holocaust, I mean, the Holocaust happened on Polish soil, right? This is where actually vast majority of victims of Holocaust have been put to death. So a historian has to come here to the archives where it all happened. But more importantly at this stage, if you want to see all the aftershocks of the Holocaust in terms of deeply rooted obsessions of people who are governing this country today, there is no better place than to come to Poland. I mean, this is a Skansen. This is a museum, sort of, you know, of how authorities today want to write again the history of the Holocaust in order to make it an agreeable, nice account, pleasurable and pleasing to the palate of the Polish population, which is an absurd proposition, but they try nevertheless.
It's certainly a good place. Is Poland a safe place then to study the Holocaust?
I would have to say it's no longer a very safe place, especially if you are a Polish historian. Your chances for grants are growing slim. Your chances for dismissal, if you are working in a government-controlled institution, are getting greater and greater. Your chances as a graduate student of getting your diploma recognized also diminishes, and so on and so forth. And on the very physical level, you can see that words have a tendency, you know, to be transformed into action. And there is this deluge of hate against independent scholars like my colleagues, myself. Our faces are plastered, you know, on title pages of right-wing magazines, in TV, state-owned TV, with horrible, you know, comments. So in my case, I have not been physically yet assaulted, but not nice, it's not pleasant. It's a question of time. The authorities have released forces, which I don't think they control, and it's not looking good here.
The voice of Professor Jan Grabowski, who no longer has to apologise for what a book he edited had to say about a Polish man who collaborated with the Nazis. Let's now talk about some of the issues that we touched upon in that interview, as well as the wider question of Poland's apparent slide towards authoritarianism and historical revisionism. Remember that it's not just been about this court case. In recent weeks, Poland has passed a law on media ownership that critics say is designed to curb press freedom, and a law on restitution that effectively blocks anyone from making a claim for compensation or for property that was seized during the Holocaust. This week, Israel and Poland spiralled into the worst diplomatic crisis of their history, and the Polish Deputy Foreign Minister suggested Israeli school trips to the Nazi death camps were propaganda. In a moment, we'll be joined by the Israeli author and journalist Nadav Ayel, but let's begin our discussion with Lord Pickles, Eric Pickles, the Conservative former cabinet minister, and Baroness Deitch, Ruth Deitch, the crossbench peer. Baroness Deitch, you've previously told the Jewish News that Poland is squatting on the property of 3 million Holocaust victims. I know this is an issue that's personal to you. There's property belonging to your family that's ended up where it shouldn't be. Presumably, you now feel they aren't squatters anymore. You feel that they've impounded property that's Jewish-owned.
Yes, it's all part of a pattern of Poland trying to rewrite the past, to whitewash the past. And it started with trying to obliterate the Jewish history. And it's moved on now to trying to block people from talking about it, as you see in the recent court case. And it's moving on in even perhaps more sinister directions. I noticed that this week, since the Afghanistan crisis, Poland's reaction has been to send troops to its borders to stop migrants coming, because Poland has always said that they will only take Christian migrants, a phrase that is rather chilling to those of us who want to help refugees of every type. Poland is also flouting many European principles about the rule of law, the independence of judges, the independence of the media, and pollution. But above all, it's hurting, quite unnecessarily, people whose memories go deep into Poland. No one's really asking Poland for a great deal of money, really not even any money at all. It's a question of getting Poland to acknowledge that there were the properties of 3 million Jewish people. And by the way, there are many more non-Jewish people in the same situation, not just the Jewish issue. And they ought to acknowledge that the title to those properties, whether it's my grandfather's house and oil refinery in Ustki Dolny, or whether it's my grandmother's block of flats in Krakow, and all sorts of other properties ranging from tiny to huge. We want Poland to acknowledge, like every other European country, that that was owned by Jews. And it's the biggest theft in history. And Poland should be held accountable and not try to rewrite history.
You say acknowledge. How should that acknowledgement manifest itself? Are we talking about a Polish law of restitution?
Well, there's a range of remedies. You could have a Polish law of restitution, certain, because Poland remains now the only country in Europe that has not found a way to settle Jewish claims to property. And that can range from setting up a fund. Austria did it rather well. They set up a fund, fairly small, and organised it very well so that people who had a claim received a small amount. No one is talking of evicting people from where they live now. It's more a question of acknowledgement, turning the page. Austria set up a fund. They didn't require people to have too many bits of paper. I mean, I've told you about my family. I haven't got any documents to prove it. I've been back to the ancestral village. They know, but I've got no pieces of paper. I did hire a lawyer, but that was a waste of money. So you could have a fund, or you could do what Germany has done, the Stolperstein, those little plaques in the road indicating that somebody lived there and was taken away. And there are a whole range of issues in between. Plaques on the wall, donations, acknowledgements by the village, and so on. But Poland won't discuss it.
Lord Pickles, you've tweeted about this, I noticed, in recent days. We've come a long way, haven't we, since the terrorism declaration, the days of that 12, 13 years ago, when Poland was one of many countries that, in a non-binding way, admittedly, but did sign up to a public international declaration to say that Jewish property was taken and hasn't been returned.
Yes, 47 of them signed up. And I just want to say I agree with every single word that Ruth has just said. And there is an attempt to rewrite history, and that modest little tweet that I put out yesterday is an illustration of that. immediately I got monstered by some people, I don't know whether in this country or in Poland, saying, you are a liar. Poland didn't sign the Terezin Declaration. It's completely untrue. We attended the conference. So I put the declaration, a link to it, straight up. And you can see from memory, they were the 33rd country to sign the declaration. We've come actually quite close on a number of occasions. There was a reasonable scheme on, which just from memory was a 20% scheme in terms of compensation. And I think we could have gone into some kind of negotiations, but Ruth is absolutely right. The Austrian scheme was the one that myself and a number of other countries were pressing for, because as you rightly say, it's a reasonable scheme. It's a scheme that it does work. The big question now is, are lending institutions going to be willing to play a reasonable hard ball? Ruth talked about Krakow, but it's even more obvious in Warsaw, where a substantial amount of property was of Jewish ownership. And I'm not entirely certain that people invested in Warsaw, that they can be absolutely 100% certain that they're giving good title. The court case that we heard of was about the only bit of good news that came out of Poland last week, and clearly a demonstration that this ridiculous intimidation on academics, we've seen that also in terms of the appointment to places in museums, where there is a determination to remove people who have a rounded view with regard to Polish history and replace them with ultra-nationalists who can't come to admit in public that while lots of Polish non-Jewish citizens saved Jewish citizens, a fair substantial number did not.
In your view, what tools, what levers does Britain, does the British government, does British civil society have to try and pressure Poland to see reason, or at least to not pursue such a nationalistic interest, which seems to be the biggest driving force behind what's going on at the moment?
I mean, we have to be realistic and understand that this measure is wildly popular within the parliament, and it goes beyond the governing party. And it featured in the recent general election in Poland. But I think the most important thing to get across, both us and our allies, and in particular the United States, which is it's not over. You can pass all these pieces of law, but it's not over. I mean, I still feel that the United States Congress has yet to flex its muscles on the JUST Act. I mean, it was pretty damning, the section that dealt with Poland. And I think Poland's got to kind of realise it looks to America for all kinds of things, but there has to be a degree of reciprocity. Our objection, wanting to publicly note it, has not exactly been received in Poland with universal acclaim and happiness. Meetings have been cancelled and a rattling of diplomatic swords have taken place. What they need to understand, this is not going to go away. I mean, the very anvil of the Holocaust, which is Poland, can't be the only country that doesn't seriously address this issue. And the real sadness, as I was saying earlier, is we actually came quite close to putting a deal together. We've done quite a number of things with community property. And of course, if there was a representative of the Polish government on this call, they'd also say that it's possible to pursue it in terms of a civil action, though that's hideously expensive. So they've got to understand this is not going to go away, and it should be raised regularly into government meetings.
If Poland is the anvil, as you say, of the Holocaust, then Israel is the Jewish state, and it's appeared after the Holocaust, and there are many reasons why it appeared as a result of what happened in Poland. We're joined also by the journalist Nadav Ayal, who can talk to us a little bit about Polish-Israeli relations, because while we talk here in Britain and in the United States about disappointment and about the difficulties in trying to see Poland see a different way when it comes to Jewish restitution, and it comes to discussion of history and the Holocaust, Poland and Israel have gone in a completely different direction. They've both withdrawn their ambassadors. And Nadav, I wonder, in your recollection, has there been a time when Polish-Israeli relations have ever been this bad?
No, this is probably the worst crisis that we have seen since the establishment of the relations after the fall of the Eastern Bloc And what we're seeing right now in terms of the language used by both sides is quite harsh. This is not diplomatic language anymore. This is more of history or a cultural confrontation. It's about all or nothing. So we see ministers in the government saying things like, "Haratzachta vegam yarashta," did you murder and also inherit? And this is really things that Israel was very careful to make sure that it differentiates, of course, between the death camps and the concentration camps, most of which established on Polish ground, and the German responsibility, the Nazi responsibility for the Holocaust. And we're seeing this coming from the party of the foreign minister, of Yair Lapid, who's really leading this charge with the Polish. Now, it's true that consecutive governments did not like this law, condemned this law, and saw this as a very worrying sign. But it's Lapid who decided to make this a full-scale crisis of the sort that we're seeing right now, which goes really to the very basis of relations between the countries. Basically, what Lapid is saying is that the ambassador can stay there. And this is not me paraphrasing him. He said, basically, the ambassador can stay in Poland. He shouldn't return right now. Even when you do this, you know, in diplomacy, there are ways to do that. And this foreign minister is saying, you have gone completely overboard with this. And this also connects to Lapid's basic agenda. And his basic agenda is about democracies and nationalism and the way that Israel is part of liberalism fighting against populism and nationalism. So he sees the greater game here, and he wants to align himself with Western democracies. Although I'm not sure that Israel should spearhead this struggle right now. And he's getting some heat in Israel from this, from the opposition and other parties.
I'm interested in that heat in particular because, as you know, I mean, Lapid is leading or one half of a very fragile coalition in Israel, and it succeeded a government led by Benjamin Netanyahu, and Netanyahu was at one stage trying to join the Visegrad group, that four-nation group of Central and Eastern European former communist bloc countries, to try and build relations in a closer way in that sense. And all of a sudden, we've gone from that to a complete schism. The public resonance, I guess, is one aspect of it. But I just wonder, how fragile is this? If the government collapses, will Poland's ambassador be back?
It's possible. I don't see the collapse of the government coming anytime soon. And when I say anytime soon in Israel, that means in the next couple of months. So, you know, I don't really believe that a Likud government or right-wing government is going to take us back to relations with Poland's, I would say, semi-nationalist government. Considering that this conflict is about heritage, it's about history, it's about responsibility, and it's about property of Jews in Poland or the families of Jews who have lost their lives. The deputy Polish foreign minister has suggested to limit the delegations, Israeli youth delegations, coming to Poland to see the camps, to see the death camps, and mainly Auschwitz, but not only Auschwitz. And what he said is that sometimes it's not orderly fashioned, and because of this, there's hatred towards the Poles as a result. First of all, the critique as of itself, it has some weight. And you can actually consider it. And there is a lot of criticism within Israel and the education system within Israel about these youth delegations and the way that they are conducted. But the fact that he would bring this up means that the Poles are also inclined to escalate right now from their own domestic reasons. They're not trying, you know, to ease these tensions. And they had their chances because the US, as was mentioned before, I think, the US basically warned them, do not sign this into law, you know, do not authorize this with the president. You don't need to go through this. And they decided to go through this. As for to Lapid, Lapid is very resolute about Israel being part of that coalition. And he really believes in that. This is basically the type of liberalism that he's preaching for. It's a sort of a conservative liberalism. It's not progressive left-wing liberalism, but the sort of liberalism that you would expect democracy trying to defend themselves. And I think he thinks that this applies very well to the US and that the Americans would be really happy with it, but it's not the reason he's doing it. It's also a family matter. Lapid is the son of Tommy Lapid, who was a former minister in Israeli government. He was a Holocaust survivor, the late Tommy Lapid. And he himself saw a lot of responsibility with the nations, the Hungarians, or in this case, the Poles, who did not resist the Nazi murderous machine.
Yes, and that's a fascinating perspective on the Israeli side. Ruth, I wonder if I could come to you on this. I guess what's interesting me in this discussion about Poland is it's clear that there's a nationalist government there. Nadav called it semi-nationalist, call it fully nationalist, call it nationalist on steroids or whatever. I'm interested in what feeds it. And one of the sentiments that you do hear when you speak to Poles who will identify themselves as patriots or nationalists, and when they are confronted with things that their ancestors have done, is to say, I cannot accept that my ancestors have been quite so vicious, so evil, and therefore it cannot be true. And I realized that the significance of me asking this to somebody whose parents, grandparents, grandparents were on the receiving end of such of viciousness. But is that a sentiment that you can relate to at all?
Well, I can understand it. But listening to Nadav, my suggestion is that we try to settle this in another forum outside Poland. I suggested a year ago that this could be raised at the Council of Europe, of which Poland is a member, and it does deal with human rights, or indeed even at the United Nations Human Rights Council. That's two possibilities. Another possibility is, and I'm not an expert on this, but when money is owed from England or the UK to Poland, or indeed from elsewhere, whether those who are transmitting money to Poland might cream off a bit of it to create an international fund to recognise those who've lost their property. And then again, keeping up the pressure, there is every year something called the Belvedere Forum, which is a meeting between high-level British representatives and Polish. And I've been a couple of times. And it's very much of a loving, you know, how fantastic are the relations. And when I've tried to bring up problems about Poland, whether it's the rule of law or Polish restitution, I get sat on pretty firmly. There's an unwillingness, I think, to bring up these awkward issues in relation to Poland. And going back to your original question, this kind of distancing themselves from the sins of their grandparents is rather unlike the Germans, isn't it, who have sort of taken that on board. So I think that's what's going on, this kind of resurgent Polish nationalism, which was sat on for so long by the Soviet Union.
Eric, you wanted to come in on that.
Yeah, well, as Ruth will recall, I did a presentation to the Belvedere Forum when it was in London about the proposed defamation laws. If you recall, I practically needed her protection because the audience went absolutely wild. I'd never seen politicians become so aggressive. You know, I put it in very diplomatic and reasoned ways. And the thing about this particular, the restitution, is in most cases, they go through a process like this and then pull back, but they haven't this time. And they feel confident that they can withstand international pressure. The truth is, I don't think the Polish government gives even the slightest concern with regard to the Council of Europe or the UN, but they do care what America thinks about them. And I can't help but feel that that's our best point of pressure to deal with this. But the atmosphere is deeply unpleasant in terms of even the mildest criticism. You find yourself being subject to the most obscene kind of interventions.
Whenever I raise this, it might happen now, I get in Polish very nasty, unpleasant emails, anti-Semitic emails. Somebody once sent me the cover cartoon of what I believe is the Polish equivalent of Private Eye. And it showed an obviously orthodox old man with a skull cap and ringlets with his arm around a young kid, looking at the outlines of Warsaw, it was obviously the Warsaw skyline, saying, my son, one day all this will be yours. In other words, they see it as a sort of Jewish plot to take over great swathes of Warsaw. And of course, you know, we don't see it like that at all. We're just trying to get justice, that's all.
It's been deliberately revved up. No one is expecting people to be removed from their property or evicted. And the politicians know that. But in the recent campaign, there were lots of scare stories about Jews coming to evict you from your property. Lots of concern. You know, President Duda signing this, I went to the, I think it's called the Uma Museum in Makoa in Poland, which relates to a family that saved a Jewish family. In his speech opening that, he admitted, made it clear that there were plenty of Jewish collaborators with the Nazis. I just don't see President Duda making that kind of speech now.
We're very nearly out of time, so allow me to jump in and come in with a very irritatingly broad question, which I think will be one of those ones that we can return to in a year or two, perhaps. But it's clear that Poland is a divided society, and we've already mentioned that we don't have anybody from the Polish government here to talk about their side. But the recent presidential election showed that Polish public opinion is divided just as much as it is in many other countries. But I wonder, given what Nadav was saying about the extent of entrenchment both on Israel's side and Poland's side when it comes to their diplomats, dispute. I do wonder how long this is going to go on for. So allow me to finish with a broad question and throw it out to all three of you. Perhaps let's begin with Nadav. Do you think that this time next year, if we came together again to do this podcast, we would be looking at a Poland that is more constructive with the issues that Jews and their sympathizers are concerned about?
I don't think so. I think that we should remember that quote by Kissinger saying that Israel has no foreign policy, just domestic one. And I think it's true for every country, actually, and more so for Central and Eastern Europe. I think that they don't have a real interest. There is a context here which is really important. And that context is that we have seen, for instance, declarations of Poland as to memory and history. We have seen for years the Israeli government under Netanyahu sort of trying to silence this in the name of cooperation, in the name of blocking a Palestinian state. They needed the cooperation of Central and Eastern European populists and nationalists there. That's the truth. And they didn't want to make too much of a conflict of it, including that, again, that declaration as to history and the history of the Holocaust, which was heavily debated in Israel. And I criticize it. And I had the same responses that were mentioned here from Polish Twitter handlers, you know, attacking me for months on end with anti-Semitic remarks. So there is a basis here for this confrontation to last. And I don't think it can become more constructive unless the United States really tries to push the sides and mainly the Poles to be more constructive. And I don't see, I read thoroughly and spoken with people in Washington after Secretary Blinken said what he said. I don't think that they want to enlist themselves into a new Middle East process just between Central and Eastern Europe and between the State of Israel. I don't think that they're there. They don't see this as, you know, a thoroughly important issue for them. For that reason, I think we'll just see more of the same.
Eric, it could be fixed if the United States gets involved, but they're unlikely to. Do you agree?
Yes, a lot of American troops in Poland. They are very dependent. And the remark about whole domestic politics will have a kind of residence there within the United States. Any movement won't be absolute. There will be things that will go that will be conducive to remembrance of the Holocaust, proper remembrance of the Holocaust, dealing with Jewish citizens and with former Jewish citizens. It won't be absolute. There'll be things that will happen that could. I mean, the court case is a prime example. In a glum week, there is that. Just at a time when the international community had written off the Polish judicial system, it is... more than capable for standing up for human rights.
So, Ruth, a possible sign of optimism there from this court case this week?
Well, I don't know what happened to this particular move, but there was a time when the USA was being pressured to not give visa waivers to Polish citizens, in other words, to make visas difficult for Poles until the government did something about restitution. Ironically, Poland has got one of the best museums in the world recording the history of the entire Jewish settlement in Poland, in the Museum Poland in Warsaw, which I recommend to everybody, and that keeps the memory alive. But as far as the future goes, as long as there are people like me who are ready to hand on the stories to the next generation of how my grandmother apparently escaped from a concentration camp, was found by a Pole and sent back. How relatives gave their two little children to a Polish neighbour to look after, together with all their money, and came back and found they'd murdered the children and kept the money. Every Jewish family, or at least many Jewish families, have stories like that. And as long as we pass those on, we won't be able to come to terms with Poland as a supposedly modern European state. It isn't that, in my view, not just from the angle we're discussing today, but so many others relating to the rule of law. It's still stuck in some kind of communist or fascist past, I'm afraid.
That's a powerful point on which to end. Baroness Deitch, Ruth Deitch, Nadav Eyal, and Lord Pickles, Eric Pickles, thank you so much for joining this episode of the Jewish News Podcast.
And that's it for this edition of the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. To find out more, visit www.gpg.org. All that's left for me to do is to thank our guests, Professor Jan Grabowski, Baroness Ruth Deitch, Lord Eric Pickles, and Nadav Eyal, our producer Justin Cohen, Adam Bradley for his work in post-production, and you for listening. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast app. That way, you'll hear any previous episode and be informed when new episodes become available. Don't forget that for more information on this or any of the stories we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. And if you'd like to comment, then we'd love to hear from you on editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Michael Daventry, do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast, and goodbye.